51. A mixture of gullibility and cynicism is prevalent in all ranks of totalitarian movements. And the higher the rank, the more cynicism weighs down gullibility, she wrote. That is, among those gulling the public, cynicism is a stronger force. Among those being gulled, gullibility is, but the two are not so separate as they might seem. Distinctions between believable and unbelievable, true and false, are not relevant to people who have found that taking up outrageous and disprovable ideas is instead an admission ticket to a community or an identity. Without the yoke of truthfulness around their necks, they can choose beliefs that flatter their worldview or justify their aggression. I sometimes think of this straying into fiction as a kind of libertarianism run amok. We used to say, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. Too many Americans now feel entitled to their own facts. In this too free marketplace of ideas, they can select or reject ideas, facts, or histories to match their goals, because meaning has become transactional. But gullibility means you believe something because someone else wants you to. You're buying what they're selling. It's often said that the joiners of cults and subscribers to delusions are driven by their hatred of elites. But in the present situation, the snake oil salesmen are not just Alex Jones, QAnon's master manipulators and evangelical hucksters. They are senators, powerful white Christian men, prominent media figures, billionaires, and their foundations, even a former president. Maybe the belief that these figures are not an elite is itself a noteworthy delusion. It's true that these leading lights of the right often portray themselves as embattled outsiders, but they're not. They're the status quo gone rogue. They are still powerful, still insiders, but something even more potent is changing. You could call it the zeitgeist, or the arc of justice, or historical momentum, or just demographic reality. The world is moving on. Those who'd rather it stand still are eager to push narratives depicting these shifts as degeneration and white Christian, heterosexual America as profoundly imperiled. A lot of conspiracy theories are organic, or at least emerge from true believers on the margins when it comes to topics like extraterrestrials. But those at the top of the conservative America have preached falsehoods that further the interest of elites, and those at the bottom have embraced them devoutly. Though when we talk about cults and conspiracies, we usually look to more outlandish beliefs. Climate denial and gun obsessions fit this template. Both originated as industry agendas that were then embraced by right-wing politicians and the right-leaning public. For decades, the fossil fuel industry pumped out advertisements and reports and supported lobbyists and front groups misleading the public on the science and import of climate change. The current gun culture is likewise the result of the National Rifle Association, NRA, and the gun industry pushing battlefield-style weapons and a new white male identity, more paramilitary than rural hunter, along with fear, rage, and racist dog whistles. I think of it as a cult because guns serve first as totems of identity and belonging, and because the beliefs seem counterfactual about guns as sources of safety rather than danger, when roughly 60% of gun deaths are suicides, and self-defense by gun is a surprisingly rare phenomena. Right-wing political fictions have a long history, from Joe McCarthy's bluffs about communists and the government to the United Nations black helicopters of 1990s paranoia, to an endless stream of stories portraying immigrants, Jews and Muslims as sinister threats. The digital age and then the COVID pandemic caused many of us to withdraw further from contact with people unlike ourselves, and pundits and social media offered those others back as phantasms and gargoyles leering at us through the filters. We all have confirmation biases, and of course leftists and moderates have also entertained delusions and paranoia about extraterrestrials, vaccines and political assassinations, for instance. But mainstream figures in the centre and on the left are not pushing radically counterfactual stuff akin to the conservative lies about COVID-19, let alone trying to instigate or whitewash the kind of violence we saw on 6th of January. Democrats operate on the basis of reasonable factual premises and usually accept the authority of science, law and history, while Republicans uninhibitedly push whatever's most convenient for their goals and incendiary for their base. Of course, some of these stories are proxies for existing beliefs. Betharism was a roundabout way of saying a black man could not possibly be a legitimate president. The raucous about critical race theory is wrong about its actually being taught in schools, but right in that how we think and talk and teach about race has shifted from when whiteness was unquestionably supreme. Issues from climate to COVID are anathema to the right because solving them would require large-scale cooperation in conflict with the idea that individual rights should be paramount. That may be why conservatives framed all COVID precautionary measures as violations of individual freedom. Dying for your beliefs has taken on grim new meaning. Since vaccines became widely available, counties that voted heavily for Donald Trump have had nearly three times the COVID-19 death rate as counties that voted for Joe Biden. Quite a lot of these stories about everything from elections to epidemiology are as dangerous as they are false. Beyond the violence at the Capitol on 6th of January are numerous incidents of true believers in Mr. Trump's big lie threatening and assaulting election workers. In one case in Houston, Texas in October, a former police captain who had been hired by a wealthy Trump supporter allegedly ran a repairman off the road and held him at gunpoint, claiming falsely that he had as many as 750,000 fake ballots in his vehicle. Reuters reported in June, election officials and their families are living with threats of hanging, firing squads, torture and bomb blasts. It's as though Donald Trump's supporters believe they can bully truth itself into submission. Democracy is premised on the belief that we can trust ordinary people to make consequential decisions. It's in some ways an Enlightenment ideal premised on another Enlightenment ideal, the triumph of reason and the capacities of ordinary people. To buy into it, you have to believe that people will be more loyal to principles and discernment than to leaders in groups, and in that sense, democracy has always been a risky project. If democracy requires independent-minded people who can reason well, autocracy requires the opposite, people who will obey orders about what to think as well as what to do. While Republicans assault voting rights and the integrity of our elections, what fuels their advances is the rise of gullible sector of the public, ready to follow their leaders wherever they go. What's often described as a weakness of the Democratic Party, the existence of a variety of views and positions freely debated on or even fought over, and a restless, questioning electorate is a strength of democracy. The Republicans remain committed to punishing and casting out dissenters, such as Representative Liz Cheney, who has been ostracized since she recognized the criminality of 6th of January, only further inhibiting open debate and these days inconvenient facts. Authoritarians don't just want to control the government, the economy and the military, they want to control the truth. Truth has its own authority, an authority a strong man must defeat, at least in the minds of his followers, persuading them to abandon facts the standards of verification, critical thinking, and all the rest. Such people become a standing army awaiting their next command.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Revolution depends upon spirituality and God's assistance. In the opinion of Imam Khomeini, the essence of power is an attribute of perfection, and God also possesses this attribute in its absolute sense. Imam said in this regard as following: power is a form of perfection in itself. Allah, the sublime and exalted, is powerful. As such, one should not shun power. Instead, he should understand it and benefit from it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam and our deeds. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that it was the power of Islam and the power of faith that drew people to unity. And it was the unity and the power of faith that led people to victory. Now here he's talking about two things, and it all depends on our deeds. It depends on the Islam and our deeds. The number one thing is that the unity has come because of the faith and because of the power of Islam. In the Quran, Allah has clearly said that وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا, do not dispute, do not get separated. And you need to have the rope of Allah in your hands firmly. You need to firmly hold the rope of Allah. This rope of Allah is Quran. This rope of Allah is Islam. This rope is faith. And because we are the followers of the Master of the Faithful, Amirul Mu'mineen, therefore this rope which we are holding, this causes us to be united. Therefore, this is the power of Islam.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
Sallallahu alayhi.
Salli ala.
If we are truly following the Islam, not looking at our own desires, not being after our own desires, then if we are following Islam through our deeds, through the true following, we all will be united. And once we are united, then no one can harm us. This is the power of unity. This is the power of Islam. This is the power of faith and being mu'min. Al-mu'minu akhul mu'min. The believer is the brother of believer. Al-muslimu akhul muslim. The Muslim is the brother of Muslim. So we have these narration verses which says that once you have entered into the Islam, you have become Muslim, and later when you become a mu'min, you all are the brothers. There is one entity, and that is Islam. And on the second part of the speech, Imam says that it was the unity, because we have this unity, and the power of faith, because we had faith, that led people to victory. Therefore, this unity and power, because they were united, no one could harm them. Therefore, they had this victory. Therefore, this is a lesson for us that in today's world, if we want a victory, if we want to gain something, number one, we need to be united. Number two, we need to be faithful. Our deeds should be according to the Islam, because if it is according to the Islam, if we remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah remembers us. And Allah says that if you call me, I reply, I accept your call, and I help you in many ways, even if you do not know about it. And Allah puts barakah, blessing, in our earnings, in our daily life matters, and in our life, inshallah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they are not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as is usually the norm. But data about what the US troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the east, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
US President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 US troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the US another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the US and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights, a lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case. During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
A major cyber attack has hit websites of different institutions in Israel. A number of websites, including the website of the Ministry of Interior and Ministry of Military Affairs, were affected. Israeli officials say the ministries of health, welfare were also targeted, as well as the Prime Minister's office. Sources have described the incident as the largest ever cyber attack carried out against Israel.
If what goes around comes around, and after all these years of attacking other people's systems, computer systems, now the Israelis are suffering their own attack.
Internet access advocacy group NetBlocks said a significant disruption has been registered on multiple networks supplied by Israel's leading internet providers. There were reports of connectivity interruption across Israel. As of this hour, all the sites are back for activity.
Yeah, it's obvious. Everybody depends on computers now. The problem here is always going to be the problem with irregular warfare. How do you know who did it? Normally, what would happen in a moment like this is that Israel would immediately accuse Iran of doing it, no matter who did it. And then they would call for the United States to bomb Iran, invade Iran, overthrow the government, and so on and so forth. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And now you're seeing, I think, the limits of this cyber warfare, because it depends on political considerations.
Earlier this year, a hacker group called Moses' Staff struck Israeli closed-circuit television cameras in the occupied Palestinian territories and Rafael Advanced Defense System, which is an Israeli military technology company. The group released the images that were apparently taken from CCTV cameras belonging to Rafael Advanced Defense Systems on January 28th in 2021. The group said it had hacked into the closed-circuit television cameras on the streets of the occupied Palestinian territories. Back then, it posted a message regarding the cyber attack on its website, titled, "We See With Your Eyes." In November 2021, Moses' Staff announced that it had targeted a number of Israeli firms and acquired a vast trove of critical facilities maps, which included information on the location and characteristics of vital systems across the occupied territories. Moses' Staff added that the data included airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and 3-dimensional images of Israeli military sites and important buildings. Moses' Staff further stated that the information it had was of immense significance. The group has hacked over 165 servers and 254 websites and compiled over 11 terabytes of data, including Israel Post, the Ministry of Military Affairs, files related to Gantz.
Yes, obviously, if the attack succeeded, they have stronger capabilities. That's obvious. But the bigger question is, who would it be? How are we going to deduce this from the evidence? The logical suspect would be Iran, because Iran has already suffered from numerous Israeli attacks. The Israelis even made a movie about it, a miniseries called Tehran, which is all about hacking the Iranian computer system.
The Electron Silag Company and Epsilor Company. Israel has been the source of tension in the Middle East region for decades. It has carried out numerous assassinations in different countries, including Iran. It's also responsible for actual physical attacks on Iran's nuclear sites. Iran has always stressed that Israel's crimes and attacks will not go unpunished, and the cyber field appears to be a new arena for this fight.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
عتبه گو آقا من دنیا رو به بدن حاضر نیستم دست و دست دشمن شما بذارم.
In the battle of Siffin, Hashim ibn Utba went to Imam Ali alayhi salam and asked for his permission to go to the war. Before going to the battlefield, he told Imam Ali alayhi salam, "O Ali, I don't replace your love with anything in the world." He went to the battlefield and he was injured. When he fell off his horse on the ground, he dragged his body toward one of the forces of the enemy, who also fell down on the ground. He put his teeth on the body of the enemy and passed away in such a position. By this action, Hashim wanted to say that he was the enemy of the enemies of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when finding him in such a position, shed tears over his body.
البته باید تمرین کرد، جوانای عزیز باید مطالعه کرد زندگی اهل بیت و نذارید قلبتون کانون هر محبتی بشه.
In order to fill our heart with the love of Ahlul Bayt, we must not let in the love of our belongings. Love is the strongest cord to cling to, so do not replace it with transient desires. Some people replace the true love with the fake ones. They replace wealth and money in their hearts instead of Allah and the love for Ma'sumeen. Why is it that some Muslims are even ready to convert from Islam to other religions to be given a citizenship of non-Muslim lands? This is a wrong replacement which will lead to chastisement in the other world. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material such as oil paints to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as seashells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs. Retired racehorses could be retrained for a new role as so-called therapy horses. According to a study led by the University of Bristol, veterans and disabled children, as well as those struggling with mental health issues, can benefit from the therapy horses. The 3-year study aims to provide a global standard for the racing industry and a toolkit for retraining racehorses. A racehorse's career can last anywhere between 2 and 10 years, but better could be done to make use of these beautiful creatures soon after they're retired.
So racehorses, when they finish their racing careers, and they can finish as young as sort of 3 or 4 years old, they really don't want to be just standing around in fields for the next 20, 30 years. And they're so versatile that I really believe there's a job for 99% of them. I think there's almost a sixth sense with the horse. People needing therapy, whether that's mental health or physical disabilities, there seems to be sort of something that gels between a horse and a human.
Horse trainers say with the thoroughbred's lifespan between 25 to 30 years, this study's aim is crucial for their long-term welfare. Over 7,000 racehorses end their career every year in Britain, with many going into eventing and pleasure riding. A killer whale beached on a Mexican shore has been rescued by locals and environmentalists. Volunteers with a group called Youth Allied to the Environment helped carry the orca out of the sea. The whale was loaded onto a truck and taken to a large dock for medical examination. Volunteers say locals gathered to form a human chain in an effort to quickly fill the tub with water. The orca is being treated at a marine biology department of the Yucatan Autonomous University. Veterinarians say the whale appeared to have some pulmonary problems and will be released back to the ocean after the recuperation.
To some people, it is just garbage. But to this Filipino woman, recyclable items have become a source of livelihood as she turns them into beautiful outfits. Leonora Biovaje is an experienced dressmaker who can weave and stitch nearly any type of material together to make fashionable frocks and gowns. She uses newspapers, plastic wrappers, and rice sacks as her clothing materials. She says rice sacks have the advantage of print and patterns, which both bring texture and color to her designs. The seamstress says she often uses packaging and bubble wraps from her children's delivery orders to make her gowns, among other materials.
It's good to use recycled materials because the cost is inexpensive. All you are really paying for is labor. It is durable, colorful, and we can help the environment at the same time.
She says her dresses sell for $30 to $50 and are used in weddings and other debut events. The recycled materials used for each dress would depend on her client's request. Her designs using recycled materials have also caught the attention of local fashion events. Leonora says she hopes to inspire others to create clothing out of ordinary recycled materials.
Elephant Day in Thailand. The country celebrates a large animal as a source of national pride and cultural identity throughout its history. One celebration took place in Chonburi province on the eastern Gulf of Thailand coast. Dozens of elephants were hosted at a famous botanical park. The animals were treated to 2 tons of fruits and vegetables laid out on a table as wide as 8 meters. Elephants in the past were used for labor, transport, and in battlefields by warriors and kings, but nowadays they're no longer used for heavy duty jobs.
And time have changed. These elephants now, they are no longer used. We have better equipment to carry log and all that, so they become what we call homely elephant. These have been their life. We train them, they rest among us, we give them food, so now they have a homely life. Hopefully life, we have to support them. So now they go to the tourist attraction place, they're riding elephant, and all this is...
The feast takes place on March 13th every year and commonly in various parts of Thailand. But this year, celebrations were few because of the COVID pandemic and the economic woes that have come with it.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Competition at stand-up paddleboard events is fierce, but competing on Europe's biggest underground lake adds another level of difficulty. One such race has been held in Switzerland as part of the 7-stage Alpine Lakes Tour. Some 60 paddlers have competed on the 300-meter-long underground lake on an illuminated course. Organizers named it the Bat Race because it was staged in a cave.
It's a great day because we're on an underground lake, and this only takes place here. There's nothing like this elsewhere, and really, the atmosphere is great because we're in the dark. We paddle without knowing where we're going. It's a really fun atmosphere.
Other athletes were excited about the setting, describing it as wonderful and magnificent. They said it was magical to see the trout deep underwater inside the cave. Others said they sometimes struggled to breathe, but all the participants agreed that it was absolutely fun.
Local fishermen have rescued an injured baby manatee on a bay in far southeastern Cuba. The fishermen are nursing the injured baby manatee with cow and goat milk mixed with coconut water. They discovered the injured manatee with gashes on his head and body in Maria del Portillo Bay near Havana. Upon arrival on shore, the fishermen recruited volunteers for a nearby farming village.
We were fishing along the shore when we saw the manatee coming. When it approached us, we realized it was injured. It had several wounds on its body, one on the head and two on the rest of the body. Between the two of us, we made the decision to take her to the port of Maria del Portillo, where the boats were moored. When we got there, the whole town was very surprised. Some people ran to help us, others ran to get milk. Seeing that it was small and knowing that it's a mammal, we decided to give it some milk. The people who have cows gave us cow's milk. Those who have goats gave us goat's milk.
Manatees are aquatic mammals akin to giant water-borne cow. The mammal is found in sheltered bays and estuaries throughout Cuba. Scientists say coastal communities could play a key role in protecting marine species and their habitats. Races, beauty contests, and a marvelous show. Here is everything you need to know about the first Qatar Camel Festival. Qatar kicked off its very first edition of the Camel Festival earlier this month at Lepsayer, Doha. The festival features unique and high-value breeds for the public to enjoy. Camels from all around the region will also get to flaunt their posture to earn the title of the most beautiful camel or the highest value breed in the festival. But first, the whole lot should be judged.
Judging is based on the size of the camel's head, the length of the neck and the beautiful appearance of the animal and its health status. Of course, judging is different for each group of camels. For example, in the case of camels that are black, the focus is on the size of the animal's head. But on camels that are white, the focus is on the beauty of the camel and the harmony of the body and the beauty of the animal. In addition, we have very experienced professional staff who will deal with the animal if it is artificially beautified.
To spike excitement and competitiveness in those who enjoy such shows, the country has allocated a whopping 47 million Qatari riyals for the lucky winners. The 45-day event will last until March 22nd and will include various competitions, including 115 local and international races.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we won't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival.
IRIB English Radio.